the Baltic states are extremely worried about this situation, and I'm really afraid that appeasement could lead to Putin seeking lands beyond Ukraine.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, I speak with SUNY Orange Global Studies Professor Michael Stromiska. Stromiska has taught and traveled extensively in Russia and Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, and is currently writing a book about non-Christian Eastern Europeans. He says we have to look at the crisis in Ukraine in historical perspective, going back 1,000 years.
The propaganda out of Russia from Putin is that Ukraine did not exist as a country until it was created by the Soviet Union. And this is demonstrably untrue. There were many different states that were essentially Ukrainian states in earlier history. True, there was not a country called, quote, Ukraine, but there were different political states that were Ukrainian in earlier times.
Can you break down that distinction for us a bit? What makes the Ukrainian people or those states different from the Russians?
Well, they're both members of the East Slavic language family. And they both go back in very early times to the Indo-European family of nations. And Kievan Rus was the first East Slavic state in Europe. And it included both Kiev, much of what we see as Ukraine today, and some of what we see as Russia. And this was indeed the first East Slavic state. So from the name alone, you see it's Kievan Rus. So you have the name Rus there, which obviously relates to Russia, and you have Kievan, which obviously relates to Kiev, today capital of Ukraine. But a crazy wrinkle here is that the word Rus originally comes from a Scandinavian people who got involved in this early state and provided the dynasty that were the initial rulers of Kievan Rus. So it's really quite complicated. Maybe an easier way to sum it up would be to say that both Russia and Ukraine trace themselves back to the state of Kievan Rus. But Russia's claim is no better than Ukraine's. In fact, Ukraine's claim might be said to be better because Kiev is an ancient city. It was the capital of Kievan Rus for much of its history. And for much of the history of Kievan Rus, Moscow did not even exist, then only began to emerge as a small city in the 13th century. Ukrainian and Russian are related languages, but it's important to know Ukrainian should not be thought of as a dialect of Russian. They're both East Slavic. You could also include the Belarusian language in this grouping, but they're all different languages. It's because of the long history of Russian imperialism that there have been centuries of Russian propaganda asserting that all of this is really Russia. But when we look at it today from an objective point of view, we can see Ukrainians have a long history, their own culture, their own language, and often their own state.
Is Putin's version of history and his view about, you know, some sort of reunification with Russia in charge, is that a widely shared position among Russians?
It's shared among a certain ultra-nationalist right-wing grouping. And one of the intellectual godfathers of this idea is a man named Alexander Dugin, who believes that Russia has a place in history as a Eurasian empire. In other words, not only the European part of Russia and the bits that people like Dugin and Putin would like to see attached, such as Ukraine, Belarus, possibly the Baltic states, possibly Georgia and other areas, but also the Asian area reaching toward Siberia. And here we find this very, I believe, disturbing idea that Russia represents the hope of the world, because it represents the hope of standing up against the corrupt, decadent West. And this is where you see a link between Putin and some right-wing leaders and media people in America today, because Putin is against liberalism. There have been many laws enacted in Russia against homosexuality that mirror some of those being passed in the United States today, like the Don't Say Gay law in Florida is foreshadowed by a Russian law of around 2010, I believe, which made it an offense to teach, quote, gay propaganda in schools. So unfortunately, this Russian view of the world seems to be shared now by some conservative right-wing people in the U.S., and I believe this also accounts for the popularity of Putin among some on the conservative Republican side, and including Donald Trump, Fox News, Tucker Carlson.
What about Ukraine and Zelensky? How has Ukraine's relationship with the U.S. and the West changed in recent years?
Well, Ukraine has been through a very turbulent period of development since becoming independent in 1991. In the 1990s, it's very important to note that Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the United Kingdom, or Great Britain, signed an agreement in 1994, the Budapest Memorandum, that stated that the boundary, that Ukraine was an independent sovereign nation, and that its borders were inviolable, and that all the signatories agreed to protect Ukraine. And at the same time, Ukraine gave up the nuclear weapons that had been positioned on its territory and made these over to the Russian Federation, or what is now the name for Russia. So the war against Ukraine now is a direct violation of agreements that Russia actually signed. Now, in the 90s and the early 00s, Ukraine had a lot of problems with corruption, which actually often involved interactions with Russian business people, because there arose this class of what are often called oligarchs, these business tycoons in Russia, who had their counterparts in Ukraine, and they were often in contact and in alliance with each other. The people of Ukraine became increasingly angry at this kind of corrupt rule by oligarchs, and that is why we had the so-called Orange Revolution of 2005, which was in opposition to this kind of politics. And eventually, a very pro-Russian leader, Viktor Yanukovych, managed to win an election in 2010 and become president of Ukraine. And he proceeded to oppress and suppress, and in some cases imprison, anyone who opposed his point of view, which was a very pro-Russian, pro-oligarch point of view. In 2013, Ukraine was in negotiation to form a closer association with European Union, which many people wanted for both economic and cultural reasons. Yanukovych was also very friendly to Russia, so he was for a time trying to play it both ways. He was playing up to the Russians and negotiating with the EU. He gave the impression that he was going to sign an agreement with the EU, but then at practically the last minute, he changed course and instead signed an agreement for closer integration with Russia. This is what sent people into the streets protesting against his government because they felt betrayed and they were also tired of the corruption that they associated with him. This led to massive demonstrations. Yanukovych cracked down brutally, killing 100 or more people. The uprising continued. The parliament impeached Yanukovych, and he fled the country, going, guess where? Russia, where he found a more friendly reception. This caused Putin to respond by taking over the Crimean Peninsula and initiating a conflict in the eastern part of the country between pro-Russian segments of the Ukrainian population and the pro-Ukrainian, shall we say, or the pro-Maidan, with Maidan being the word for the overthrow of Yanukovych, which is often considered the Maidan revolution, or also called the Euro-Maidan, because it was very pro-European. So Zelensky comes out of all this. He is part of the emerging Ukraine that would like to have closer ties with the West, would like to join the EU and NATO. And in fact, joining NATO is stated in the latest version of the Ukrainian Constitution. So Zelensky has an interesting history. He is Jewish. His grandfather fought in the Soviet army against the Nazis. Three of his grandfather's brothers died in the Holocaust. Zelensky was an entertainer. He was an actor and comedian. He had a show in which he played a history teacher who becomes president in Ukraine. That show became his launching board into politics, and that's how he became president in 2019. Initially, Zelensky seemed to want to negotiate some sort of peace with Russia to end the conflict in the east, in the Donbas region. But he was unwilling to give Russia what it wanted, which was to essentially make that part of Ukraine into a Russian satellite. And this led to Putin's increasing frustration and apparently eventually to his desire to simply invade Ukraine and overthrow the government of Zelensky, which incredibly Putin and his propagandists portray as a Nazi government. And I told you the history of Zelensky, making this quite ridiculous. And Putin claims the purpose of the invasion is to denazify Ukraine.
When were you last there?
I have had a number of teaching stints in Eastern Europe. I was in Ukraine in November and December of 2015. So this was just about a year and a half after the Maidan Revolution. And I was able to see the memorials that were put up to the people who died fighting against the Yanukovych regime. It was very moving because there's a whole area around the Maidan Square where there are all these memorials to those who died, to the dead protesters, the dead soldiers, and others. And I also learned that when those protests were happening, they were extremely dangerous for the people involved. Yanukovych had put snipers on buildings in the area, and they were taking pot shots at the protesters, who were also being brutalized by secret police who were marching on them and bashing them to bloody bits. But the Ukrainians stood together, and they created a support network where everyone in the area who could try to contribute. Some people brought sandwiches. Some people brought soup. They brought hot tea. They set up tents to provide medical services. It was an incredible effort, and it was successful. In the end, Yanukovych backed down and fled. I'm still in touch with some people in Ukraine, and what I keep hearing, what people are crying out for, is more military assistance. They feel, and I share their feeling, that America is being much too timid in dealing with this situation. I understand the concern they don't want to start a third world war. But problem is, Putin is a bully. And to put it in simple terms, if you don't stand up to a bully, the bully becomes more aggressive. Putin already took over the Crimea in 2014, and the American international response to that was totally inadequate. The mere slap on the wrist, and then pretty soon there was an attempt to restart relations with Russia. This time, what can be done? Well, you know, that's a complicated area. I'm sure you have many other experts to talk to about that. But I would just say from the Ukrainian point of view, much more needs to be done in a military way because they're fighting with everything they have, and they're being decimated. One city after another is being leveled. The death toll could go into the hundreds of thousands or millions. And if we only trickle in military aid and we're scared to do anything against Russia, we're giving Russia the victory, at least in the short term. Because it's true that the economic sanctions put in place are very tough. They are going to devastate the Russian economy in the months ahead. But in the short term, Russia could flatten Ukraine. And it aggravates me to hear people saying, well, these are war crimes, and boy, in the future, we're going to put Putin on trial for war crimes. Well, that's all well and good, and I support that. But in the meantime, Ukraine needs more help, more protection, particularly whatever technologies can be used to protect from air attack, because Ukraine is being battered by missiles. And as to the argument that we should not get more involved because we'll provoke Russia, simply by saying that, you're giving Russia the higher ground. You're saying what happens in Ukraine is determined by the will of Russia and the pleasure of Putin. So I think we have to stand up to Putin and do much more than we're currently doing.
Do you expect an independent Ukraine to exist after this? I mean, what does the future hold?
Well, of course, you know, no one can answer that because the future is unfolding before our eyes, and it doesn't look very pleasant. What I am worried about is that with many Western diplomats, including our own government, keep saying that we need to negotiate with Russia, I wonder, what would that negotiation mean for Ukraine? Are we going to allow Russia its wish that Ukraine never join NATO? Are we going to let Russia keep Crimea? Are we going to give Russia the eastern half of Ukraine, let it carve off a country that it gained through military attack and violation of international law? I'm really afraid that if we make concessions to Russia, we are rewarding Putin for his aggression. I actually think we are heading into a new Cold War. We're going to need to draw a hard line against Russia. And for Ukraine, I hope and pray that it will remain an independent nation and that it can regain control of Crimea. But I think any negotiations that reward Putin are a terrible mistake, because that also sends a signal to leaders, autocratic leaders around the world, that, hey, if they use military force against the U.S. or its allies, the U.S. will back down, negotiate, and give you a third or a half or a good portion of what you want. In other words, that violence and aggression will be rewarded through negotiation and compromise. Now, these are very difficult matters. I don't have the answer. I am afraid that Ukraine is going to be wiped off the map largely, that the Russian aggression and bombing will continue, and that the West will stand by and do nothing. And I really hope I'm wrong.
A lot of analysis about the present moment has likened what Putin's doing to, you know, Hitler in 1938 and Chamberlain in Munich. Do you worry about the fate of other former Soviet states if Putin is able to carry out the takeover of Ukraine? Are we looking at other dominoes potentially in the future?
I'm currently teaching a course online for Riga Stradins University in Latvia, because I was a Fulbright fellow there in 2020 and part of 21. And in discussing the situation with my Latvian students, they are absolutely terrified and anxious about their future. Because even though the Baltic states are part of NATO, a Russian assault could roll through those small states very quickly. And the question would then be, are we willing to stand up to Russia if they take over the Baltic states? Or will we just seek compromise and negotiation that could result in Russia keeping the territory? Do we care enough about the Baltic states? Is NATO strong enough? I think the parallel with the appeasement of the Nazis in the 30s is quite pertinent here. Remember, back in the 30s, people thought that Hitler was reasonable, that he made some concessions that would satisfy him. And now the same seems to be happening with Putin. We've had many negotiations with Putin over many years, and he's never relented from his aggressive attacks, including his attack on our democracy, his interference in the 2016 election, and the promotion of a pro-Putin candidate, that is Donald Trump. So the Baltic states are extremely worried about this situation, and I'm really afraid that appeasement could lead to Putin seeking lands beyond Ukraine.
Professor Michael Stremiska of SUNY Orange, thank you for taking the time to speak with us, and thanks for your expertise.
You're very welcome.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.